A life without regret, wouldn't that be nice? Solomon is bringing everything down to its conclusion in his final chapter. We read in verse 1 of the 12th chapter, "Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come and the years approach when you say, 'I find no pleasure in them.'" What this means is we have a pretty good chance of neglecting God when we're young. That this could be the very time period that Solomon is referring to. So barring some kind of a tragedy, we're going to face the pain of old age. This is on its way. It's hurtling toward you right now. So what that means is it's two bad alternatives. It's either a tragedy, which would be a tragedy, or it's that you live long enough to have the pain and the ache and the despair of old age. And Solomon is saying, get a hold of your life. Get into the driver's seat before you even get to that point in life. And it's going to come fast, that's for sure. I'm going to say something, and you're not going to believe me. You are going to wake up, and you're going to be married. You're going to have kids. You're going to have a mortgage. You're going to be thinking about things like retirement. You're not going to know what 403B even means. People are going to be talking about all these foreign things to you, and you're like, you're going to be looking in the mirror. My buddy and I, we went out with an old friend of ours from high school, and afterward he turned to me and he said, "Dude, did you see him?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "God, he was disgusting. I mean, dude, he just looked like terrible, you know what I mean? He just looked old, you know?" And I said, "Yeah, I guess so." And he said, "Yeah, the thing that kind of freaks me out is that how people look at us?" And I said, "Dude, we're a couple of hot dudes. They don't look at us that way." No, it does happen. You wake up one day and you start to look at yourself in the mirror and you're like, what the hell happened to me? It happens so quick. I remember sitting right where you were and I heard, you know, an older guy talk about this. It's going to come really fast and you're going to wake up and it's going to be over. And then I was like, not really. And now I'm like middle-aged right now. That's what I realized today. I'm middle-aged. I've been denying that fact for a very long time. And now I'm just facing it squarely. I'm halfway through my life. I've got less ahead of me than I do behind me. And remember your Creator, he says. Remember, before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars grow dark and the clouds return after the rain. Here he gets metaphorical. He starts to speak about the human body in the sense that it's like a house or like a city where there's workers. And so here he's saying it's like you can't see the sun, the moon, the stars. Glaucoma, question mark. I'm not saying that they knew what glaucoma was 3,000 years ago or they had the medical diagnosis. What I'm saying is they knew what happened when people's eyes went bad. They couldn't see as well. And that's what he's describing here. He says, I find no pleasure in them, these older years. Remember, when the keepers of the house tremble. Again, this metaphor of your body is like a house and keepers of the house trembling. You've seen old people. When you start to see some of the toughest, strongest people and they start to shake, they get the shakes in their hand, the shake in their head, they start to shake. And it's some of the toughest people you know reach a certain point where this just falls upon them. They can't help it. The strong men stoop, he writes. They're hunched over. People that would stand up with perfect posture, all of a sudden they're starting to have the spine curved and in on itself, and people that look so heroic in, you know, their war pictures from years ago, all of a sudden they can't stand up straight. When the grinders cease because they are few, you know what the grinders are? Your teeth. When there are few. There's few of these left in your head. They start to fall out. That's why old people get dentures, because the grinders, there's few of them. And they cease because there's just not as many in your head. And back then, they didn't have dentures. So you just looked around at people and they just saw like a couple grinders left. And Solomon's like, it's terrible. And he's writing this at the end of his life. He used to be, you know, a good-looking, attractive, charismatic, brilliant, rich, attractional guy. I mean, people from all over would come to see him. And now he's looking at himself in the mirror and he's got that tremble. He's got that stoop and he's looking at his teeth and they're falling out. Those looking through the windows grow dim, again, losing eyesight based on verse 2. Remember when the doors to the street are closed and the sound of grinding fades. Remember when men rise up at the sound of birds, but all their songs grow faint. when the doors are shut, when you can't, how's he put it? The sound fades. The songs grow faint. You can't hear as well as you used to. We all know elderly people. This is what you see. This is what you observe. And Solomon's looking at his own life, at the end of his life, and he's saying, this is what's happening to me. Remember when men are afraid of heights and of dangers in the streets, this must refer to being afraid of getting easily injured, where when you were a young man, you didn't care about this stuff, because maybe, you know, you'd jump and you'd fall and you'd sprain something, or maybe you'd break something, and they'd set it. I mean, even ancient people, they knew how to set a broken limb. But when you get older, you're afraid of that stuff. You're afraid of breaking a hip. You're afraid of breaking an elbow, a shoulder, a rib. That could be fatal. You're afraid of the heights all of a sudden. You're afraid of going out into the street. That just a simple fall, it's going to be all over. Remember when the almond tree blossoms. What does this refer to? You don't know almond trees, apparently. Almond trees. When your hair turns like that. Not in a George Clooney kind of a cool way, but in a disgusting, haggard sort of a way. When the grasshopper drags himself. Grasshopper is this. It's the grasshopper has that incredible strength in the hind limbs, that tensile strength, that it can actually jump. I don't know if you knew this. I looked it up today. 30 inches. And you're like, that's cool or whatever. But that means that if we were the same size, or rather if a grasshopper was the same size as us, it could jump the length of a football field in one jump. That is some Superman, Spider-Man stuff right there. And that's a grasshopper. And he's like, you're looking at a grasshopper. And it's got that incredible strength in the hind legs. It's powerful. It's muscular. It can jump like a football field. And he says, when that grasshopper is just trying to drag, you know, its thorax across the ground, it just can't even move anymore, can't even get off the ground. And this is you at a certain point. You're moving toward this direction where your body is shutting down. And the caperberry is ineffective. What is the caperberry? A sexual aphrodisiac. They didn't have the little blue pills back then, so they had the caperberry. You're like, why was this in the Bible? Because it's Solomon writing it. That's why. Because he had 700 whatever and 300 concubines and everything, and he was just like, damn, caperberry isn't working anymore. Then the man goes to his eternal home and the mortars go about on the streets. Could you think about that? So he's just describing, you know, your teeth are falling out. Your hair is gray. You can't see. You can't hear. You can't do other things that you really liked to do before. And then you die. You die. You're dead. You're in a casket, a coffin. And it's over. It's over forever. That's the fate that awaits us. And so he says, remember him before the silver cord is severed. More metaphor. Or the golden bowl is broken. Remember, before the pitcher is shattered at the spring or the wheel broken at the well. Remember, before the dust returns to the ground it came from and the spirit returns to God who gave it. An allusion to Genesis chapter 3, that we're made from dust, and to dust we shall return, but not the spirit. The spirit goes to God who gave it. So this is an allusion also back to Ecclesiastes, the 3rd chapter, verse 11. That God has put eternity in the human heart, and yet we're seeing here the horror of death. They died a very natural death. There's no such thing as a natural death. Every time it's horrific, every time it's a tragedy, it's horrific, it's terrible. And how do you think it would feel to be Solomon at the end of his life? A man that was so famous, so intelligent, so good-looking, so powerful, a scientist, a ladies' man, a king, and at the end of his life, he's sitting there, he can hardly get himself out of the seat. He can no longer see. He can no longer hear. And he's just looking forward to the silver cord being severed, the bowl being broken, the end of his life. While he says, meaningless, meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Remember that word? Hevel. A vapor. It's a mist. I'm looking at my life, and from this perspective, that's it. You're young and then you get older and you get decrepit and then you die and that's it. Let's pause. How valuable is your life to you? How valuable is your life to you? That's really been the entire theme of this book of Ecclesiastes. How important is your life to you? You only have one of them. You have one life, right? That's it. you're only given one of these. And there's no do-overs. It's not like you can, you know, get to the end of your life and just say, never mind, you know, Christmas Carol and redo the whole thing. That's it. You get one shot and then it's over forever. According to Jesus, he says, what would it profit a man to gain the whole world but lose his soul? What if you could have the entire, what if you could be Solomon? You could have the entire world, a harem of women, unbelievable gold reservoirs, intelligence, beauty, power, but you forfeit your soul. It's all, how's he put it? Hevel, vapor, meaningless. How valuable is your life in the end, in the final analysis? Let me ask you two final questions here. Do you trust Christ for your afterlife? I hope that you do. See, Solomon is taking us to the absolute breaking point, the point at which we just say, all right, uncle, I give up. I give up on this project of trying to find meaning in a universe without God. And Solomon says, you're ready to hear the message. You're ready to hear it. And from us on this side of the cross, we know what that message is in its totality, in its fullness, in Jesus Christ being strung up on a cross, showing without a doubt the love of God for you. So we can read, for example, in Romans 10:9, if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and you trust or you believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. No conditions, no caveats, no, well, and also being a good person and also trying really hard and also you got to fix up your life. None of that. It's just you will be saved, period. This is the scandal of Jesus that here we have among all the 5,000 different religions in the world. Here we have the one religion that says you can do nothing to earn heaven. Nothing. All you can do is trust everything to the one who earned it for you. If you confess with your mouth and believe in your heart, you will be saved. Then he says this in verse 11, for the scripture says, Isaiah 28:16, whoever trusts or believes in him will not be disappointed. You have one life. That's it. How important is it to you? There's no do-overs, and it's of inestimable value. It's worth more than the entire world. In the end, the biggest regret you could ever make is ending your life at death, separated from God for eternity. The Bible says that if you make the decision tonight, you can make this tonight. I know it seems like it's very complicated. It isn't. This is just a free expression of the heart where you say, Jesus, I trust in you and I want your death to apply for me. And when you do that, the scripture says here, you will not be disappointed. There will be no regret in that decision. You will never get to the end of your life and say, I really wish I had never received the gift of Jesus into my life. A billion years from now, you will not be saying to yourself, I really wish I never made that decision. You will say, that was the best decision I ever made. Second, do you trust Jesus for this life? To me, it seems like it would be a no-brainer. In fact, it seems like those two things should be in reverse. You know, the afterlife is forever. It's eternity. It's going on forever. And to say, I'm going to trust Jesus with my afterlife, but I'm not going to trust him with this life, seems utterly preposterous to me. Okay, so here we're going to get, what, 20, 60, 80, 100 years? And I don't know if I want to trust him with that amount of time. But I'll trust him with eternity. I'll trust him with forever. Yeah, I'll trust him with that. But I can't trust him with this 60 years ahead of me. Are you kidding me? And it's so strange because I've talked to people about this. And you read the scriptures. I mean, it's very clear, very, very clear. Jesus said, Luke 9:23, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. This is not literal. Because if you take up your cross literally, you die, and you don't do that daily. You don't do that over and over. But this is the sign of taking up your cross in the sense of dying to yourself, dying to what you want, dying to what you can make other people do for you. And he's saying you need to die to that and live for me. It's only, as Jesus puts it, in giving your life away that you end up saving it, you end up keeping it. And Jesus says this without apology. He doesn't even explain it. Could you imagine if I had the audacity to stand up here and say, you need to die or be willing to die and be willing to suffer every day, daily, every day of your life for me and follow me. Could you imagine? You'd be calling the men in the white coats to get me out of here. I mean, clearly you would just say, this guy is unbelievably out of his mind. And yet when Jesus said this, people took it so seriously that they went to their deaths in belief of him. And Jesus makes no apology. He doesn't barter with us. It's not like he's trying to make some kind of an exchange. Like, I really need, he just lays this out and says, this is the best life you could ever have, is living your life following me, period. Matthew chapter 6, verse 33, Jesus said, seek first his kingdom and his righteousness and all these other things, food and what you wear and your job and your family, all those other things, they're going to be added on to you. The kingdom of God comes first. What's the greatest commandment? Matthew 22, 37, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your might. This is the great and the foremost, the first commandment. Love for God. The kingdom comes first. Love for God comes first. God comes first in your life. And again, Jesus makes no apology for this. He doesn't barter with us. You know why? Because what kind of a bartering do you have with a God who has no needs? You know, if you're bartering with Poseidon, you can give him a little sacrifice and it makes him happy. Then he says, oh, I'll give you a good sea voyage. You're bartering with Hermes. You say, I'll give you a little sacrifice, a little bit extra. And he says, well, I'll give you a really good speech, you know, out in the temple later today. Okay. But what do you do with a God who is infinite and personal and has no needs whatsoever? What's so unbelievably, unfathomably odd to me is that you can talk to people and say, do you believe in that first question? Have you trusted in Jesus for your afterlife? And they've said yes. And they can even explain it. Like, you think you're going to heaven forever? Yeah. And Jesus paid for that. Yeah. And you believe the Bible's true. Yeah. But you don't trust God. You don't trust Jesus for this life. It's as clear as day here. It couldn't be any clearer. Viktor Frankl, the great psychologist, he's the founder of what's called logotherapy. He contended that people need a sense of meaning. And if you could have meaning, consequently, you could change many of the dysfunctions in people's lives. He himself was a Holocaust survivor. So he said the people that survived, by and large, in the Holocaust, barring any kind of intervention through, you know, a death or whatever, but self-inflicted loss or a suicide or anything, the people that survived were people that had meaning. And it was from this foundation that Frankl built this whole field of psychology referred to as logotherapy, from logos, meaning, purpose. Here's what he says in his book, Man's Search for Meaning. He says, live as if you were living already for the second time. And as if you had acted the first time as wrongly as you're about to act right now. Anybody here have regrets? Like, do you look back on your life and you're just like, why did I do that? Why did I feel like playing Call of Duty that week instead of passing my exam? Why did I date her? Why did I date her for that long? Why did I date her sister? Why would I do that? Why was that a good idea? You know, like regrets. You look back and you're just like, oh, if I could just have a do-over on that, I would. Here's Frankl's point. Live your life as if you're looking at the end in mind. Isn't that precisely what Solomon is telling us? He's starting at the end looking back and he's saying, learn from me. Learn from my example. Exactly what we're seeing here. There's a book I came across, Bronnie Ware. Now, to be fair, I haven't read this book. So I just need to say that up front. Came out in 2019. She's a palliative nurse, which just means that you're not trying to cure. It's not a curative agent. You're just there to help with the pain. You're a pain specialist. This is a part and parcel with hospice, if you're familiar with that. And Bronnie Ware worked with patients at the 3 months right before they died and eventually wrote a book called The Top 5 Regrets of the Dying. And in it, she said that most of them could summarize their regrets in these 5 different ways. I wish, 1, I had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. there's a way of interpreting this that could be cynical, where you say, oh, I see, this is the very postmodern, live for you, to thine own self be true, and that sort of thing. But notice the additional clause, not the life others expected of me. That modifies the first clause, which basically means they were living a life based on the expectations of others, rather than what they personally felt in their own convictions. Number two, I wish I hadn't worked so hard. Yeah, I remember listening to one pastor teach on this, and he said he had been to hundreds of bedsides before people died, and nobody ever said, bring me my degrees. I want to see them one last time. Bring me my awards from work. Bring me my bank account statement. They all said, bring me my loved ones. Bar none. Isn't this what Solomon has been teaching? Ecclesiastes 1:16. I have grown and increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. This too is a chasing after the wind. Oh, he worked. Oh yeah, he worked like crazy. He had building projects galore. You remember chapter 2. He was building gardens. He was trying to recreate Eden. He says this was a chasing after the wind. 2:9. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve. He was an achiever. Yet everything was hevel, vapor, mist, meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. Or 4:4, I saw that all toil and all achievement spring from one's envy of another. That's it. That's the American dream right there. It's not just that I'm working hard. It's that I need to work harder. Some people live their entire lives based on the expectations of others. They still have their dad in their head whenever they make a decision. They still have their mom in their head whenever they make a choice, living up to those expectations. Their mom or dad could be dead, and they still hear that voice in their head, trying to achieve, trying to toil, trying to be better, trying to work harder. What does Solomon say? This is meaningless. It's a chasing after the wind. Are your decisions based on cultural norms? Are they based on peer pressure, the particular social group in which you find yourself? Are they based on your family of origin? Big decisions? Guys, we're talking about your life. And you're going to say at the end of your life, well, my friend said I should do it. You know, my mom said I should do it. Well, it just seemed normal that I should do it. My social group said I should do it. This is your life. You get one. There's no do-overs. And then it's over. Forever. And you're going to hand over the reins of your life to another person? Or are your decisions based on personal convictions, not the life others expected of me? We would never say, well, people told me what to do, and so therefore I do it. But in a covert way, in a subconscious way, we pick up on the norms and what's acceptable, and that's what we're going to do. Only it's not something like a career. A career you could change. We're talking about your entire life, your values, your beliefs, the things on which you're going to rest a foundation for living. Number three, I had the courage. I wish I had the courage to express my feelings. To this, I would just say, isn't this Solomon in a nutshell right there? I mean, he is just brutally honest here. I don't think I've read a text in the Bible that's this honest. Maybe his dad in the Psalms. He's pretty honest there, David. Solomon, he's right up there with his old man, just pouring out his heart. I mean, he just says it like it is. And I guess I would have to ask the question, you know, when is the last time you shared what was really going on in your life? Holding on to things in your life for months, sometimes even years. And you're waiting for somebody to draw you out. You're waiting for other people to do the hard work. You won't actually just go out and just share, this is what I'm struggling with. This, guys, this is one of the biggest regrets that people face. At the end of their life, they look back and they just say, why didn't I come out with that sooner? Oh, I could have saved myself so much heartache, so much bitterness, so much anger, so much conflict if I had just shared and gotten the help that I needed. Number four, I wish I had stayed in touch with my friends. There you go. See, we know this as Christians. We know that happiness comes from the relational side of life, not from the material side. Ecclesiastes 4:9, two are better than one because they have a good return from their labor. If they fall down, they can help each other up. But pity those who fall and have no one to help them up. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. By the way, this is not referring to marriage. So stop citing it at your wedding. It's not talking about marriage. So if you're going to get married and you're thinking about this passage, scrap it. And if you were married and you used this passage, sorry, not sorry, you should have studied the context. This has nothing to do with marriage. Nothing. Prove me wrong. This is referring to friendship. And the cord of three strands is adding a third friend. Well, they lay down together to keep warm, not to copulate. Good God. All right. Friendship. This is what Solomon is realizing here. In a vicious, difficult world where there are so many difficulties, having a friend, just one friend, that would be good. Just to have somebody there that you knew had your back. Three would be even better. A community of friends. Oh, he probably couldn't even envision that. There's one thing that is conspicuously absent from the life of Solomon. A good friend. David had his good buddy, Jonathan. He had a prophets in his life that would speak into his life. Solomon, nobody. And Solomon looks back and he just says, I wish I just even had one. With all that money, with all that popularity, with all that fame, I wish I just had a single friend. That would have been enough. What active steps are you taking to make new friendships? Yes, Jesus said, if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Okay, that's not good enough for love. That's not biblical love. That's a baseline for love. Okay, everybody can love people that love them in return. That's reciprocity. That's troop behavior. That's all that is. Animals can do that. But can you love people that don't love you in return? Yeah, making new friendships. Also, can you maintain old friendships? I look at some people. Oh, this kills me. This breaks my heart to share this. You look at some people, their life is falling apart. And you look around and you say, where are their friends? Nowhere. They pushed all their friends out of their life. And now there's nobody there that knows them. They're alienated. They're alone. I will say, with all honesty, I know nothing of what that's like. I am not an easy person to love. But I can say, with a straight face, I've got more friends than I know what to deal with. People that love me and care about me, but part of it is maintaining this, putting the work into your friendships to keep this going. So too, responding to other people's initiation. How many times does the person need to initiate before you're going to respond? You know, if I initiate once, twice, maybe a third time, I'm going to get the message. You don't want to be friends. I'll wait until you initiate for once. You might say, well, that's not good enough. You should be more like Jesus and initiate more. Look, I got other people in my life that are taking a back seat right now. I should nurture them. I should take care of them. I can't just be going around the city chasing you down so that we can hang out. And I wouldn't expect you to do the same for me either. Friendships go both ways. We got to maintain them. We got to initiate. We also need to respond to initiation. Number five, I wish I had let myself be happier. At the end of your life, you look at your life and you say, you know, how was it? Miserable. Oh, that'd be terrible. Ecclesiastes 3:12, I know that there's nothing better for people than to be happy and to do good while they live. Yeah. He says this too is a gift from God when you enjoy a good life. It's just nothing better than that, that's for sure. Ecclesiastes 11, verse 9, be happy, young man, while you are young. Let your heart give you joy in the days of your youth. Be happy. A lot of people, they don't believe this, especially a lot of Christians. It's so funny. You talk to Christians and they're like, no, I want to be joyful. I don't want to be happy. What does that mean? What are you talking about? What does that even mean? I want to be blessed, not happy. Can you tell me what blessed means? It means to be blessed. You repeated the word. To be blessed means to be happy. That's what the word in Greek means. Makarios means happy. Of course, this happens through a life of service. When you give your life away, that's where happiness comes. When you wash other people's feet, figuratively speaking, that's where the happiness comes from, is giving your life away. But we should be happy. Are you happy following Christ? I am. I'm not going to say that there's not difficulty, that there's not suffering. I'd be lying if I said that. I will say this life I have is awesome. I love it. I love it more every year. You say, well, yeah, but you told me about the one time you were really hurting. Yeah, because we're in a fallen world. Come on. We're going to hurt. We're going to suffer. We're going to weep. We're going to grieve. Of course that's going to happen. We're in a fallen world. But I can tell you, my life is real happy. I remember sitting there with a bunch of friends for a birthday, and they all brought a video of encouragement. And just to sit there with all these people encouraging me in a room full of loved ones and family, and there's nothing like it. What a great life. What a great life. Thank you, God. Yeah, I'm not rich. I don't have all the other things Solomon had, but I've got true success. Love relationships. Well, does this mean that Christians can't have regrets? Well, we can, yeah. In fact, I brought along a little clip from Billy Graham. It's like Jesus, Paul, Peter, and then Billy Graham. So he says, although I have much to be grateful for as I look back over my life, I also have many regrets. Apparently Christians can have regrets too. I have failed many times, and I would do many things differently. For one, I would speak a lot less and study a lot more, and I would spend more time with my family. That was one of Billy's biggest regrets. He didn't spend time with his wife and kids. When I look back over the schedule I kept 30 or 40 years ago, I am staggered by all the things we did and the engagements we kept. Were all those engagements necessary? Was I as discerning as I might have been about which ones to take and which ones to turn down? I doubt it. Every day I was absent from my family is gone forever. Much of that travel was necessary. Some of it was not. Okay, quick caveat here. Billy Graham was an extreme outlier. I know some people read that and they're like, oh, so we shouldn't be highly dedicated to Christ. No. No. Billy Graham was all the way out in the parking lot, right? He was so extreme in his dedication to Christ. He spoke to 210 million people, 185 countries. You know how many countries there are on planet Earth? 195. So he made every country except for 10. And he's like, I should have backed off a little bit, okay? I should have spent a little bit more time at home, okay? So let's get this in perspective. Oh, man, I'm really... You know, serving the Lord, I'm a real slave of God, you know, by having to hang out with my friends a few nights a week. Okay, when you get near 210 million people that you've spoken to about Christ, then we'll talk. But he was just saying here, as he looks back, he should have cut back. He should not have neglected his family, and that is a good lesson we should learn. As we think about this, we should emphasize quality, regular time with your family. Yeah, that would be a regret if you look back and you didn't disciple your kids weekly. Weekly time. I know a lot of you don't have kids. I don't care. Someday you will. And I just want to put this on your mind, and I hope that this bugs you until you do have kids. That you would meet with your kids. You would study with them. That they would look to you with love. That they would love dad. They would love mom. Creating these kind of margins where you're not doing all these extra non-essential ministries. Like, you got it right down to the bare bones, the things which are most important, and you stick to that. And you don't add all these extra things all over the place. I've taken some criticism for this. People are like, well, where were you here? And why can't you teach this? And why can't you go over there and do that? And I'm just like, I'll think about it, you know. Here's my thoughts on parenting. Have your kids grow up in a family where they get to see both mom and dad serving God. I've had people say, so what do you suggest? I'm about to be a parent. What do you suggest? My suggestion, get yourself into Christian work. That's what I suggest. So that they get to grow up looking at mom and dad serving other people, making a sacrifice for other people. Oh, I don't know. That's going to be kind of hard to juggle all that. Hell yes, it's hard. Yeah, it's hard. We're picking up our cross. This is going to be tough. I don't know. That could be kind of suffering. Yeah, you're going to suffer. This is Christianity 101. This is going to be difficult. Well, I don't know, man. There could be a lot of spinning plates, and I could be dropping some of them. So what? Who cares about that? You get under grace, and you deal with it. But you keep moving forward toward Christ, and your kids get to see this. What a gift. What a gift to be able to hand that to your kid. Two models of sacrificial love. Well, end of my sermonette on that. Billy Graham, he says, I would also spend more time in spiritual nurture, seeking to grow closer to God so I could become more like Christ. I would have spent more time in prayer, not just for myself, but for others. I would spend more time studying the Bible and meditating on its truth, not only for sermon preparation, but to apply its message to my life. It's far too easy for someone in my position to read the Bible only with an eye on a future sermon, overlooking the message God has for me in its pages. And I would give more attention to fellowship with other Christians who could teach me and encourage me and even rebuke me when necessary. He's like, I wish I was rebuked a lot more. I can't imagine rebuking Billy Graham. That would be so hard to do. What would you even say? About one thing I have absolutely no regrets, however. I do not regret my commitment of many years to accept God's calling to serve him. Yeah, boy, that guy suffered. Boy, did he work. And he looks back and he looks at that and he says, I have no regrets about that. Well, we conclude in verse 9, might as well finish out the book. Not only was the teacher wise, but he imparted knowledge to people. He pondered and he searched out and he set in order many different proverbs. The teacher searched to find just the right words, and what he wrote was upright and true. The words of the wise are like goads. Those are the sharp object, you know, that poke a horse, get it moving. He says these words are kind of like that. Maybe you felt that as we were studying this. A goad where you're like, ah, that kind of hurts, but it's got me moving a little bit. They're collected sayings like firmly embedded nails given by one shepherd. That's God. It's claiming to be inspired. Be warned, my son, of anything in addition to them. Of making many books, there is no end, and much study wearies the body. Now, all has been heard, and here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of humans. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. So. This whole idea that Solomon was like a nihilist, or an existentialist, atheist, you know, I just didn't believe in anything, everything's meaningless. He was pushing us right to the brink, showing us that nothing in this life ultimately matters. Not temporarily, not transitorily, in a temporary sense. There is no ultimate significance. And he just pushed and pushed and pushed until we get to the end and we say, so what's the answer right here? God. He's there. He's watching. He loves you. He wants to come into your life. Let me just remind you of that, what we shared earlier, that if you want a relationship with God, don't go this way where he's going to look at every good and evil thing you ever did. Get under the cross of Jesus Christ, where your sins have been bought and sold and paid for. You're forgiven. Then the second decision would be building up trust to live for him. Let me conclude here. What are your regrets? Maybe as we sat here tonight, you could think of something for which you have true regret. Yeah, I've already got a few myself. I look back and I just think, why? And I know we were kind of goofing around earlier, but you think about that and you're like, that was a regret. I regret that. Guess what? The story isn't over. I remember talking to one guy. He was just like, man, you know, everyone else is just like so ahead of me spiritually. And it's just like they're off to the races, you know, serving God and everything. They're so into God and, you know, I'm just so behind and everything. It's just nothing's working. Guess how old that guy was? 19. 19 years old. Oh, I'm just too screwed up. Too many mistakes. Dude, get a grip. The story is you just started the race. And yeah, somebody's a little bit ahead of you. Who cares about that anyways? Run your race. Don't focus on the past. Focus on the future. Not looking at what lies behind, but reaching forward to that prize, Philippians 3. In a word, Solomon has labored to communicate a single point. The point is this. Don't be like me. Where you look back at your life trembling, half blind, teeth falling out of your head, gray, old, stooped over, about to die, and you look back with big regret. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth.